You're listening to the Riverfront Church broadcast, a place to explore faith, history, ideas, and more.
I'm Pastor Emma.
And I'm Pastor Edward.
So we're gathered here with some friends. Who do we have with us today?
We have Angela Sheik, who is actually a big-time Wilmington celebrity and has since, greater Wilmington region, but also has traveled internationally, has performed internationally, has gotten some awards, has had some really good success in the music scene, especially and looping, which we're going to talk about what that is because there's still people that ask me, what? But she is now in California and pursuing the music career there. So we have her. So say hello for a second.
Hey! Not awkward at all on podcast.
And then we have Meredith Estevez, who's been a guest a couple times before.
What's up?
And she is an oboist, performer, and teacher. So, and kind of connected with the arts community.
What's up?
They're the exciting people. We're just pastors. So we get to have the privilege of hanging out with really cool people. Because it's your birthday, you get to go first.
Sure. So one of the things I really love about being around really creative people is just to hear them talk about the things that they love and why they love them and the creative experiences that they like to live into. What brings you joy? Which is about 27,000 different questions in one. So feel free to answer any of that.
But give us the elevator speech of joy. Why should we fund your joy? Angel investors listening on this podcast.
I think what gives me joy is discovery.
Okay.
So I'm always after that. And whether that's putting a pen to a white piece of paper and just saying, where is this going to go? Or if that's picking up an instrument that I don't know how to play or have no business playing and just seeing what happens. Yeah. The delight of discovering something. Mm-hmm. Or even in somebody that I've known a long time, suddenly seeing them for the first time in a new way, it brings me absolute joy. So,
Wow, that was really well done.
Nailed it.
Podcast over. I think for me, you know, I when I'm making music or writing, I feel like I connect to God and like God's creatorship. And, you know, we're all in awe of the world around us. And so it's cool that when we sit down, we call on a spirit that, you know, made the mountains and made the sunset. And we have that kind of creator power in us. And so I like that idea instead of me being like, oh, no, I have to come up with a great idea. and then if I make something great, it's because, you know, of something outside of myself, so I can't take too much credit. And if I make something bad, then it's not my fault because it's not me. So I like that collaborative aspect of being creative and the fact that we can call on this great muse outside of ourselves, which I believe is God. So.
And there seems to be, I mean, I don't know, this is as a layperson outside of the music world, seeing
a though?
Contract.
Are you though?
I listen to it. But there seems to be a contrast because similarly to preaching, right? So you're looking at a text that's thousands of years old in terms of being told, you know, orally and passed down from generations and then written and then translated. I mean, you're just seeing there's all this creative and technical processes that have happened. But pretty much every Sunday we're preaching on a text that millions of others have had access to and have had to study. And in some ways that reflects sort of the classical world where there's a sort of set repertoire and you mess with that. And that seems interesting, having a musician that kind of almost looping. So tell us a little bit about what looping is, because it seems to really be able to take on any repertoire.
Well, I would love to touch on what you just said, because I think that's really a part of what I said.
What is it called? Synchronicity.
I'm reading a book right now. I've been reading it for about 10 years. I'm a very slow reader. But it's about the idea that the job of the artist is to discover new in the old, in the ancient. Because we're not really saying anything new, ever. But how to breathe life into something that's old. And I think there are some poets that really open that up beautifully. I can't think of the name of this poet, but she talks about making the stone stony again. Mm-hmm. Something in your life that is just you've gotten used to. Could be a spouse, you know. Yeah. Could be a person. It could be the smell of cooking bread or whatever. But you make it new again. And I've just been really thinking about that as my job as an artist, you know. And I think there's something we really have in common there. Staring at something that's old, like romantic love. Haven't we killed this horse? Right? Isn't this a gazillion years old? Yeah. But. How to breathe life into it.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't know how, I mean, he made the comment about classical music, but I would venture to say it would be really for all music, because absolutely. If we're using Western scales and, you know, there's only so many notes, so, you know, we're still, the framework is still like a constraint. It can enable you or it constrain you. You have to decide, but we're still kind of using pre-existing materials that are indeed ancient and sort of, in some people's view, they are tapped out.
Right. Well, but looping's cool, though.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to looping, because just side note. Is the poet Mary Oliver?
Yes.
Oh,
thank
is it?
You.
Oh,
that's
there we go.
It, is.
It sounded very
yeah,
Mary
yeah,
Oliver.
Totally
so I was
did.
Like,
yeah. I was thinking that.
Might be Mary Oliver.
Yeah. I need to dive more into
She's good. She's good. All right. So tell us, what is looping? If in case you've never known, this
is
the moment.
What you should do is, speaking of horrible segues, demonstrate Tiny Desk Concert right now.
So if I could give you, well, you're a percussionist, right? So the groove is kind of like a swing. And then... it's a four-bar loop. It goes do 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 tire, do 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 do. So I get that loop going, and then I sing on top of it.
Oh, tell me, why God leave me? Why God leave me? Leave me for that.
You get the idea. Yeah. Dude, that's pretty cool.
I was in it. I was like,
I know, like we're
going to
go on and on. Yeah.
Angela actually went to the restroom while that was happening. And we just kept playing it. That just sounded great.
And I'm sitting over here like, don't look at me. I
saw you shrinking. I was like, I won't force it.
That's very good reading.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
So there's a machine that you...
Yes.
You record yourself doing each of those.
I would love to have humans to do that all the time, but limitations.
Well, and how much in performance are you kind of changing your mind? Like, how much prep do you do versus like letting it be improvised?
Yeah, I do a ton of prep so that no matter what happens, I'm cool. So I do have a plan always, but I get very creative in front of people. Like, that's when it really starts to turn on. So I'll be like, oh, we should try this time. And it's train wrecks. But at least I've practiced enough that I can hopefully rescue it without looking stressed. That's the prep. It's just.
And how often, how hard? I've never played around with one of those machines.
You should.
Like,
oh, my goodness.
I think it would be cool to, play oboe into it.
Yeah.
But would it, how often does it, malfunction? How long did it take you to feel like you were really confident enough to go out there and do how many layers do you what's your max layers?
Yeah, I have actually gotten the it's hard to do, but I have gotten the message from the looper like, I can't do this, too busy or too fast. Back off, lady. So you can reach its capacity, any machine, but yeah, I think probably I spent... Well, I lipped I lipped... Oh, my goodness. Kombucha is going straight to my head. I looped...
Kombucha, by the way, is fermented tea, ancient Chinese fermented tea, and it has a small percentage
of alcohol. This podcast was brought to you by Synergy Kombucha.
But we
ginger
did not
a
know
flavor.
She was bringing kombucha, so it's not pre-approved for the studio.
Sorry
about that. Okay.
I should have checked it.
And we're not at a United Methodist church, so it doesn't matter. So it's cool.
So what was the question?
You one time looped.
Yes.
How many?
Okay. So I was a peripheral looper for a long time. Like I had a partner for a long time, and we just used it for percussion.
That feels like that describes a lot of people. Just peripheral loopers.
Loopers. Most people are. I think that's the best way for most people.
What does that mean?
What does that actually mean? So that means I was primarily playing keyboard or some other instrument, and the looper would just be going on for maybe too long in the background, keeping a beat or bringing it in the chorus. I didn't have him, so. Yeah. This is me beatboxing right now, by the way.
While you're talking.
Yeah. Is me. Same. So, and then I tried to play with bands and drummers. Mm. They weren't so enthused to have a loop pedal. Long story short, I played one gig where I wanted to play this one song. The drummer and bassist were just like, we don't want to deal with that. And I said, all right, I'll just do it with me and the looper. People lined up after that show to say, my favorite song was just You and the Looper.
Yeah.
And it just shocked me. I wasn't expecting that. And my knees were knocking. So.
And the band's like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
it saved expenses. And then the budget.
It definitely saved expenses. And I could be a bit obsessive, so I could practice as much as I want and not tap anybody else out or drive them crazy. And then I started writing songs with it. And that was really the magic for me, is using that. We talked, He Who Shall Not Be Named was talking about limitations before we started the rolling of the podcast. The limitations of the looper, that it had to be a certain amount of bars, or you had to come back to it, you had to hit stop, you had to hit record. Just instead of having a piano with too many chords, that you could just go off into insanity. I fell in love with it. I fell in love with it. So, yeah. So, but really, the 2 weeks of just me and a looper hashing it out, and I took it out to an open mic, and I was just shaking like a leaf. I had all these bracelets on, and it malfunctioned, but we got through it. And that they say performing in front of people is like practicing 50 times, you know. Mm. And that was it. Really playing that for the first time in front of people was like, okay, I can do this.
Cool. Well, and have you found? You know, it's kind of an amazing thing to think that like the medium that you work in was something that you like happened on accidentally.
Yeah,
like, that's really cool.
It was
like,
many happenings.
Yeah, how did your training as a musician lead to that moment with the looper? Like,
wow,
that's a great question. Because so, were
that's
you trained
question.
As a musician or are you self trained?
Yeah.
Or?
Well, I was a flute major. We're talking like, you know, I think dinosaurs were roaming the earth. Yeah. But then I taught school. I taught middle school and high school band for 8 years and started kind of playing a little bit on the side. And I think as a classical musician, you are taught to take critique and you're taught to practice more than anything, like to really bust your butt to get something right. So I would play on the looper and the looper would come back and say, you're flat and you're late. And I'd be like, I'm not! But you can't argue with the looper because he's always right. So as I'm learning the looper, I think I'm becoming a better musician because it's giving me immediate, harsh feedback.
Oh, wow.
You know? But definitely, yeah, just to practice. I think how to practice. Not give up.
Cool. So again, so it's a little bit like, so I had a little keyboard when I was a kid that we found at like some garage sale. And I could press a button and it'd give a beat. And
yes.
Then press another button and there was trumpets playing. Da, da, da. So that was like the proto. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was like Casio. It was like the proto looper. That was the proto looper.
They were so ahead of their time. I love those.
And then they just kind of, I don't know what happened to them. Maybe they
I have a few.
Okay.
But yeah.
And hopefully that's why kids aren't playing out in the streets now. They're just hanging out in the looper. Loopers are a part of what's going on in our society right
now. Is it?
No, I don't think so. But
they're worried about looper time.
Yeah,
kids in looper time.
Looper time.
Before the age of four.
Congress has
really
looked at banning loopers. But so if you're the audience listening to this, it's imagine that keyboard in a sense, right? A machine that's capable to layer different sounds or a tape deck.
Yeah. Because the tape deck had that red button that you hit it when you wanted it to capture whatever you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had a black button right next to it to hit stop. That's basically my looper, except it would put that tape that was in that tape, it would put it on a little circle of a loop.
Mm-hmm.
And it would repeat, whatever you want.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So going back to now I'm curious, like, so what? How many layers have there been? Like, what's the highest?
The highest?
38, 92,
Oh,
10.
Man. That's a good question. I think when I'm, I tend to write really thick and then have to edit back. So when I'm writing a song, it probably is, it probably gets up in 50, 60s.
Oh my gosh.
Well, just layers, you know, it's not, yeah. And I'm doing that with a headphone because if you had a live audio, that would make a feedback that there's no way you could handle that.
Oh.
So.
Wow.
It's always a consideration.
And so I wonder, like, when you're recording an album.
Yeah.
Or a track, do you do it live every time? Or are you, like, truly, like, doing all of them separately and then layering them? Or a little bit of both, maybe?
Well, this is an interesting question. I would like to hear your thoughts on this. Because I've always approached the album to be different than a live performance. Mm-hmm. Like, one does not work the same as the other. And it's fun to watch somebody when they're looping if they're being visual about it. Bringing up a bright new red accordion that you get to look at while they're playing something. But when you put that on a four or 5 minute song, it doesn't translate to me to a recorded album as well. Like I had a theremin solo. That thing was so boring on the album. We're like, we can't keep this in here. It just sounds like, rawr, 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 you know.
Yeah.
So I have always approached album as a different art than live performing.
That makes sense. Yeah. I don't know much about production and like how all that gets put together. I mean, I know from a classical perspective, when I made my album, it was almost assumed that it would be highly edited, and that, you know, so we recorded the same track over and over and over until, quote unquote, it was perfect. It never was, but we find the most perfect quarter note, and then we like cut it and splice it to the next 16 note pattern, and you know. And if you have a master engineer,
it's called comping.
Yeah, that's what really shows. It's not always how you play, but like how good your engineer is.
Absolutely.
And so
magic.
I'm not surprised that when you're using electronics, like in performance, that, that the making an album would be like a whole other art form. Like again, it's like another medium.
Yeah. No, that's how I've approached it. People have different opinions, and I've often handed an album to somebody at a show and said, "Sorry, it's not the same as what you just heard." So I don't know. I've thought about that over the years and thought maybe there should be a live album and a studio album kind of a thing.
Yeah, that would be cool. Well, and I like that there's an immediacy to your live performance. Like I think that's to me as a person who enjoys live music, like I think that's really important that there is something we can get that we can't buy on a CD.
Right.
Like, it's more than paying for Spotify. It's like showing up and being in a room with people and the ambient noise and like any mistakes you make and like being there in that like live moment of music. I think that's really cool.
Well, we were just at a house concert on Sunday night where there was a dog with a very jangly collar. And people were like apologizing, but I love that. No other night had that sound, you know, that keeps it really fresh and real for me. And I'm also like, how can I? That's kind of a cool rhythm.
Yeah. I don't know if you like.
And that's why you're wearing these bracelets because it's
is.
Like, it is carrying
there's,
that sound.
I don't know if you like Ani DiFranco, but this is going to like totally date me. But like,
they were digging a new foundation in.
Yes, they used to make in a record as in a record of an event, the event of people making music
in a room.
Whoa. Now every you probably did the whole song.
Mm. Cross marketing, you choose.
Yes.
Or Guns and Drugs, you choose.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
right?
It.
Pretty good.
What has been the role of faith for you and how you see that in your classical teaching, performance, learning, etc.?
Well, I mean,
it's got to be really good.
I think
this is really important.
I think that faith calls us into a way of life that is full of hope instead of despair. And anytime you're vulnerable out in the art world, you need hope because it's really easy to get down real fast when you're getting criticism and when you're coming up empty in terms of feedback and all that. And I think that, again, like it connects back to that thing that when I do something quote-unquote brilliant or, you know, that gives me accolades, I don't... You know, I can't let that go to my head because I have a collaborator. And this talent, any talent that I've been given wasn't something that I, you know, just worked hard to get. It was something that was given to me by God. And so then I see it as a gift and I see myself as an instrument into doing something beyond myself that maybe could speak to the creator that made me and speak back and echo the gifts and goodness I've been given. So it takes the pressure off and it makes it... makes it more like an exchange and a discovery instead of like, hey, look how great I am.
Yeah.
Angela, now the question is for you. So what's the role of faith? I mean, a way to also say this is you could do a theological or reflective response, but you could also just tell us a story. What is the story of faith in your
Meredith music? Has me thinking, because lately I've been writing a lot of music for film and TV, which means you have to have paperwork, which means you have what's called a split sheet. So whoever was a writer on that song, you just have on paper the expectation that it's split evenly or whatever. Now I'm thinking, God should be on the split sheet. But
God's like, yeah, that tithe and offering is on the split sheet there.
10%. Amazing. So ask the question for me again, because kombucha.
So what has been the role of faith in your, specifically in your music career?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, you know, it's played some different roles. It's played some different roles for me, but you know, I think I grew up in the church, and I always was connected in faith at some level, but I feel like a lot of my experience up to the last couple of years was dealing with doubt more than faith, and a lot of my music was wrestling through that, you know. Like, God, I can't deny you're real, but list of questions, you know, so all kinds of things like that. So really doubt and faith dancing together has been a big part of my artistic exploration. And then more recently, I think going back to that word discovery, I feel like I've just had an awakening in the last couple years where I realized how tightly I was holding on to some things, because they gave me security, they gave me identity, they gave me worth. And just realizing how much my hands were bleeding because I was holding so tight onto those things. We may call them dreams. We may call them hopes. We may call them idols. But they became a bad thing for me. And I've just been rediscovering what it looks like to be free. And what it looks like to be led by a greater power that we would call God. Yeah, so I feel like I'm kind of on a newer path for that. And I hope it's coming out in my work. Just more of a trust and less doubt. I've been learning on this journey that, like, doubt isn't the absence of faith. Doubt is its own thing. Doubt is something else. And it can be a tool, like hunger, but it can also be really negative if you let it overtake you, you know. So trying to have more faith and more joy and more peace and less doubt. Putting doubt in its proper place in the tool belt. I think the other thing that I'm learning, because of my faith, I have rest. Because my identity doesn't rely on my work or what I call myself, a musician. You know, a few years back I had a crisis where I thought, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. And then I was like, what am I if I'm not a musician? Just like a, I don't know.
People wouldn't say hi to you anymore. They'd
be
like, guys, it's Angela.
Yeah.
Huh?
Formerly known as a musician. Yeah, who is that? Yeah, no, so it means a lot to me, or meant a lot to me, what I did. And that I was an artist, and that defined me. And I think just really learning what Jesus meant when he says, it is finished, that it means that I can relax because the work has been done, and I don't have to prove anything. I don't have to write anything profound. I can just walk. I can just be. I can just, you know, I can just be in a conversation with you, and I'm not in charge with how it goes. I'm just a little character in this bigger story. So that's made a world of difference on many levels. Even approaching an audience of people, of strangers or a mix of people I know and don't know. Wow. Just that we have been brought here. That's faith, you know, that it's not random. That I wrote this song for reason A. I'm here because of reason B, C, D. But it all is connected, and there's a connector.
You know, I think that's... Hearing you say that is really interesting, because I so I'm a pastor, that's what I do, but that's not all of who I am. And I remember reading someone's bio one time, and it was like, the church is my whole life, and I'm just a pastor. And I just remember being like, I don't want to be that. That is exactly 100% not what I want to be. So that search for being larger than that job title, than that calling, than that thing that you might feel so strongly about is something that I really hear when you're saying that. I'm like, yes, that's me. Even though my thing is not music, my thing is church.
Anything.
That faith thing. So I kind of really loved you talking about you sharing those stories and how I connected to that. Because I'm like, yes, me too. I do other things.
Well, that's something I've learned too, is if you just say what you know to be true, some little bell rings in other people.
Right.
And it's kind of amazing.
I loved what you said about hunger and doubt, because
feel free to correct me theologically.
No, I really loved it because it was like hunger is also a desire.
Yeah.
So what about doubt as a desire for faith? This last week, I think it was, I was preaching on the gift of... Of course, I can't remember what it was. We're doing a Gifts of the Spirit sermon series. And it was...
acting graciously?
Acting mercifully. Oh. Yes, there we go. And so it's like if you have the gift of mercy. And so I did... I kind of introduced the Rosenberg's nonviolent communication piece. And I always love revisiting that. And, you know, it has... There are people that critique the system. It's not like a perfect system that's going to bring about world peace. But I think it is... And a really interesting system. And he developed it in the 60s in the midst of unrest, Marshall Rosenberg. And he was influenced by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and then Mahatma Gandhi. And he was just trying to find a way to forward. The thing is, he focuses on the individual rather than systemic change. So that's kind of the critique that they make of him. But what I love about it is in one of the lists he has assumptions. And he says, basically, we all have needs, and we're always expressing these needs through our feelings. Mm. And so somebody who's angry, rather than, oh, this person's just angry, it's like, well, they're expressing something. They're expressing some kind of need. And so that's why I loved what you said about hunger and doubt, because it is doubt simply an expression of, I'm desiring something. I want to feel like I belong. I want to feel like... my life has meaning beyond this moment, which is fascinating because I think we're living in a time where people are misappropriating or misunderstanding what being present is. It's like, have you guys ever been in like serious pain in a hospital? And it's like, I don't want to be present to that pain, right? I want someone help me, bring me water. I'm thirsty, right? So I want to be careful about what we really mean by that, which is, you know, making peace with our past, having a hope for the future, and also being able to be present to needs in our present. So absolutely, that I agree with. But I also think that looking at the assumption that we're expressing needs, and so doubt is an expression of wanting to belong, wanting to have meaning. And I almost, and I think it's different for every person. For me, it's always like, am I pleasing God? Not am I earning God's love, because that's scripture tells us that's a non-negotiable. We have the love of God, and in fact, the love of God is already at work in our lives even before we realize it. But am I in return, in response, pleasing God? Just like if, you know, any of my friends or my colleagues or my family members, if they, you know, express love to me, I would want to respond to it. I want to say thank you for the card. I'd want to give them a hug if they were hugging me. So that's been liberating to me to think about my own doubt and questions as opposed to them being, sort of
pointing to.
You know, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Instead of them being like, I don't like you, God, which I have had those moments in the past, but I have seen my faith develop in that now my first go-to is not, where's God in all this? It's like, where is God in all this in that I'm not seeing it? It's more on like, I'm clearly not seeing it because I believe God is at work.
Mm.
So how do I open my eyes and open myself to experience or become more vulnerable? So I love that. So I'm going to totally take that hunger and doubt thing and I'm going to like
split
apply
sheets.
It to a sermon.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
because I just think that's so beautiful. I do think the church hasn't always done well in terms of how it deals with doubt and addresses doubt. We call doubting Thomas, you know, like as if it's like bad, and it, and it's what leads, it's the doubt that leads Thomas to have an encounter with Jesus.
Yeah.
And Jesus, you could say that the next statement is him reprimanding Thomas, or that it's all, or simply that Jesus is saying, by the way, many of those hearing the story or reading it thousands of years later won't have the opportunity to touch me in this way. So blessed are those who believe in spite of the fact that they cannot touch or see. So maybe that's not a reprimand of Thomas. Maybe that's just a hopeful offer for us that we can believe even without Thomas's direct experience of Jesus. So I don't, and also he then believes, right? He's the only disciple that proclaims you are in fact the Son of God, right? He has this declaratory moment. So he's not doubting Thomas. He's believing Thomas, right? And the doubt led him to it in a sense. So there, so I really like that image of seeing doubt as a desire for faith, you know?
Well, I'm so glad that there is, there are pictures of doubters in the scriptures. That's a big part of why I would still call myself a person of faith today. You know, even the David and the Psalms, some of his doubting Psalms, Psalm 13, or Psalm 4.
Yeah.
You know, many are asking who can show us any good. Those verses have really just kept, when it was just down to an ember, have kept that faith alive for me, because it was people who I think doubted well and just showed me a way forward. Yeah, I think a lot of my doubt, even today, but it's just at a much smaller, you know, it's at a different proportion. Longing for cohesion in my faith, longing for cohesion between the people of faith, and just kind of the bubbles that we find ourselves in. And,
right.
And how we can get a nice echo chamber going of with people that believe the same as us, but when we step out of that, how often do we step out of that?
If we step out of that,
Should we ever?
And it also, this lines up well with Thomas Aquinas has this great line in his theology that says, faith seeking understanding. And he doesn't see those separated. There isn't just understanding somewhere out there and there's faith over here. He sees them, well, how could they possibly exist independently of each other, you know, faith. So faith, sometimes we, so in a way, just like you're saying about doubt, we make doubt this bad thing and it's this negative thing. And, you know, so we want, you know, shelve it. And the day you wake up, especially if you're a Christian, the day you wake up with a doubt, well, that's just your fault. You're the problem. And so we create all this pressure on ourselves. And again, we make it about us earning God's approval and love rather than, no, you have it. You have that. Right. But on the other hand, we also caricature faith. You know, we say, oh, faith is simply going, that's what it says. Great. Yay. Oh, conversation over. No discussion. There's no wrestling. There's no struggling. And it's like, well, that can't be what faith is either. Because even Paul, my favorite scripture, Romans 8, he says, for I am persuaded, or some translations say, for I am convinced that neither death nor life. But I love the term persuaded or even convinced, because it means it took him something. Like, so he had evidence. He wrestled. He struggled. He encountered. He rose again. He doubted. He then had to, you know, think about it again and fall to the floor and rise again in his faith and in his doubt. And finally, he can say in his last, what we think is one of his last letters before being killed, is, for I am persuaded that nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. But he had to get there. He doesn't write that in his earliest letter, 1 Corinthians, right? It's finally toward the end of his life. And that's just so reassuring to me. You know, that's like, Paul, wow, because you're pretty awesome. Like, you know, person of faith, you know, faith in action, great theological thinking that to this day, of course, informs and guides the church. And you're also wrestling, you know, and wondering and trying to articulate what seems so hard to articulate. So
I was thinking about, I think it's Galatians 1 as well, where he is unpacking the gospel to a believing church. Just reminding me, like, oh yeah, we need that. It's not like there's not a point where we don't need that. I need that a lot. I need that message.
I grew up in a Hispanic Presbyterian church and then also Pentecostal church. where my grandmother would take me Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday nights. And so I have a pretty interesting spectrum, and that's come up before in our conversations. And then I have another side of the family who's Catholic, so I just had all this diverse experience. But what I remember is in the Presbyterian Church, there was just a general goodness that I sensed about God. I felt that I was loved, even though I had done nothing to earn it. I was 7 years old. I didn't even have the concept of earning God's love. And in the Pentecostal Church, for all the beautiful experiences I had there, that's when the concept of earning God's love really came up for me. That it was like, I have to do this, and I have to stop doing that, and I've got to start doing this, and I've got to add that, and then I've got to decrease this, and then have you read that? And so I started adding all these rules, and inevitably, I started getting with, am I loved by God? Like, and then later, I kind of left the church for several years. I left it, let's say at least, I don't know, who knows, 10 years or something, maybe more. And then I slowly came back to it. But ultimately something I still wrestle with, like I really can only say this has been about a year or two, and it's similar to your experiences, looking for freedom. Yeah. And the freedom that the scripture talks about and the idea of God loving us, whatever we've done or not done. And so that's what's interesting about what you said about Galatians with Paul telling them the gospel. It's because we seriously can talk about this and rejoice and tomorrow wake up and go, I've got to earn God's love. I've got to get God's approval. I've got to make something of myself. I've got to validate myself or else I'm nothing. And and we just get so caught up in those cycles.
Well, it takes one email. It'll take one bing from that phone before I am back there.
One comment, one text, one Facebook, you know, like or dislike, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I just think that's why we need that story over and over again. I've got to say, I love you guys, everybody who's in the studio, but I haven't met the person yet that's like, oh yeah, absolutely loved by God. I've seen the glimpses. I've seen the...
Come to LA.
Yeah, come to LA. It's all over. It's in avocados. You know? It's everyone eating avocados. But no, it's just so, or let me say this, there have been very few people, I mean, like five people. I mean, most even people have been in the church all their lives, they're pastors, they could have an amazing ministry. But have I heard them speak or experienced them as like, oh, I'm absolutely loved by God. And there's not a thing that can take that away from me. And whatever I've done and haven't done. And it's just like, I mean, even as a preacher, I'm like, yeah, I can say that. But like, am I living it out? Have I been transformed by it? And that's what I loved about you saying seeking freedom in your music. Because there can be so much of like, is this, how are people going to take this or not take it live? Or, you know, is it going to do well? Or and what does that say about your work? And so I just want to say I'm excited for you.
It's so exciting.
Walking into the freedom that I think is our exit.
It's great.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's such a relief.
I think my thing that I've been sort of thinking about as y'all have been talking is that the kind of looper-based music, I don't know what the official term is, isn't it very like individualistic? So you're in control of, I mean, there might be producers and editors later on down the row, but then thinking about how that interplays with doubt and, you know, in times in my life, I feel like I am, I'm not sure if I can do the thing. Well, if I can just do it, then, okay, that doubt goes away. And so that interplay between your kind of songwriting, putting together musicality on that individual, I can fix this basis, I can make this as good as it possibly can be, but then how that matches or doesn't match with the way you've experienced faith. I am saying a lot of words. Can you explain this?
I'm trying to get a hold on how to respond to that.
Yeah. Does this question make any sense at all? The interplay between the individual nature of some of the music that you make and as much control as you have over that, and then the kind of lack of control that you have in faith. That's a better way to ask that.
Yeah. More than a looper, I'm a music producer, and that part of me resonates with what you're saying for sure, because that is a lot of time, you know, you are trying, you have a song and you're trying to elevate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're trying to make it the best that it can possibly be, and sometimes that means going back to the actual bones of the song and changing something about it before you, you know, try to polish. You know, we're in a church, so I don't want to say what you're polishing, but yeah. I think as far as how that
comes back to faith. It is, well, there's a magic about it. There's something that's outside your control where you're trying to make the best decisions possible. Mm-hmm. And yet, in some beautiful days, it just takes on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. And you're just walking through going, wow, this is so cool. Look what's happening. Look what we made together.
Right.
There's also a huge element of trust. I've been doing so much co-writing and collaborating at just a whole nother level. I've done a lot of that here on the East Coast, but that is a thing. That is a thing out there, just co-writing, because connections are, yeah. Some people are so much about that. But you walk into a room knowing that person knows how to write a song, but you don't know them very well or haven't seen them in 2-3 months or whatever. And there has to be this element of trust and relationship that is, again, just... To me, I use the word discovery or magic, or it's just something that I get to watch unfold that I couldn't necessarily have forced open, and it's beautiful. And faith, I think, is a lot like that, you know? Like you bump into somebody, and instead of my usual immediate response is like, get out of my way, I have things to do. But instead, as you rub shoulders with people, you say, oh, why is this happening? Mm-hmm. You know, and it just, it's a different way of viewing the process. Yeah. Yeah. Does that answer what you were trying to ask?
Okay. Yes. The question that will make me sound real good on.
Yeah, right.
I also love, so we've talked about doubt and now in talking about, we've talked about doubt and faith, but in moving more toward faith, I love that term of discovery because I think that's a less scary term for people seeking faith or learning about faith or asking questions about Jesus or the church or, you know, because so much of it, I don't know if this happens for you guys, but people I meet are all about, okay, what are all the things I need to believe?
Right.
What do I need to
get
right?
It seems binary.
Yeah, yeah.
You're in or you're out. You're yes or you're no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do I have to memorize? What do I have to be... You know, et cetera, et cetera. Add the whatever the to-do lists are.
Yeah.
You know, these 5 things and the 9 steps and the whatever it is. And I love instead of saying, what about discovery?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a really good friend who about 2 years ago did not really believe in God. And he had this really powerful conversation with a mutual friend who's helped out with the 505 service before. And he just said this beautiful statement. He said, well, you know, it looks like you've been trying to find faith because this guy had seen other people have great lives and have faith. And he said, well, something's missing in my life, but I don't know that I can buy this. And he said, well, instead of you trying to find faith, why don't you let faith find you? And he said that just changed everything for him because it stopped being about his understanding, his effort. It just like, okay, I'm going to let faith find me, whatever that means. And what that has meant is over time, he's kind of come to church and he and I have become really good friends. And he came to a place and he was like, you know, Edwin, I think I believe in God now. I've experienced that. So, oh, okay, great. He's like, I don't know about Jesus though. I don't know. And then, you know, a year later, he's like, you know, I'm smitten. I want to follow Jesus. And I don't even know what that means, but I want to do it. I said, okay, great. And then it got
I'm with you, brother.
Yeah. And then it got to like 3 months ago and he was like, I think I'm ready to join the church, you know? And it's like been this 2 or maybe it was even 3-year process. And it's just been so beautiful because for him, there isn't all the baggage. You know,
yeah,
he
right.
didn't really, he grew up in, you know, sort of an environment where you did it traditionally, but that was kind of it. But he really grew up without all the baggage that comes with it. And so for him, it's been discovery. So we're reading like the Gospel of Matthew together in Sunday school. And he's just, whoa, that's really strange that Jesus said that. And that's it. It's not like, whoa, 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 wait, that violates section C.2 if you say that about Jesus. It's like, what if faith were actually this fun exercise like music and art and the world? Mm-hmm. Like you just discover things.
Yeah.
You know, it's not you figuring it all out and having it right. And then you turn in the exam and you get an A and now you can be a Christian. You don't become a Christian in a sense on your own.
Yeah.
You know, you're made a Christian. Mm. You know, something happens to you.
Right.
You know, and for you.
This sounds like my husband is was raised Muslim and Unitarian and then came late in life to the church. And it's been interesting. He's got, you know, he has like an app where he reads the Bible and he's got a lot of bookmarks. He's an engineer, so. And one of his bookmarks is called "What the ... question mark." Okay. It's interesting to see what's in that. But it's
the entire Bible.
Yeah. Well, he calls me his pocket theologian because he'll be like, "No, it says this, right, Ange?" You know, and then I'm supposed to pull up, so back up, which doesn't always go so well. But it is. I think that's beautiful to watch, and I think that's the spirit we should all have is that of a beginner in a sense. Mm. When you start thinking you know it all, you're in trouble. Mm. You're in trouble because your edges are starting to get crusty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think if we can keep that idea that there's something new to be gained today, and even in somebody like your friend discovering the church, this is an opportunity for me to get to know this God better through him, through his eyes, through his experience.
Yeah.
It's all of us moving
right
in a direction.
And I love it. I've been to a concert before where I was really moved by the music and people who had studied all their lives and knew the composer. And I was like, oh my God, let's say it was Eric Whitaker, or if it was, Morten Lauritsen, if I'm saying that correctly, or Paul Mueller, I think that's his name. If I'm making this up, sorry, but and I just was like, oh my gosh, I'm so moved by their music. And I'll never forget that what they said. And they were like, oh yeah, that's so Eric Whitaker. Or they were like, the ninth movement or whatever is very pompous, but the third piece is really,
it was better last Wednesday.
Yeah, and I just remember people walking off stage just going, I can't stand playing box number two, postlude, whatever that means. But and I just was like, wow, that's so discouraging. Like, and I feel like people of faith can do that,
absolutely.
Right? They're like, oh, don't, even
absolutely.
On whichever side, right? So it could be
I think it's more prevalent than we would care to.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Care to.
Like, it's like I've heard Christians tell me, like, oh, Paul, I don't like Paul. And it's like, so what would, in other words, so you've lost your curiosity
right.
for Paul. Like, what if you've misread Paul? What if Paul's been misinterpreted for you?
Mm-hmm.
Or what is there to still discover about Paul's life that might be a blessing to you? That helps you grow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
But we can get so used to it or taken for granted, like making the stone stony.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the Mary Oliver poem. So,
well, that's our job as an artist, I think, partly to see that in the church body. That's part of our job. Maybe I always say I'm the big colon or whatever the colon. I'm filtering. I'm a filter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to filter out this waste.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Colon in the body
of
Christ.
It all comes together. And Paul says, everything I've ever done to earn God's love is like excrement.
Yay!
So there we go. And
it might have been
good.
Yeah. No, but we need to get that out so that we can be healthy.
Yeah. Mm. So the discovery piece is so fascinating. So I love that. Faith as discovery. And having fun with it and going like, there's
it's amazing.
There's no way for you to go outside of the boundaries of God's love. So there's no, there's no moment of like, well, who made God? I remember asking that as a kid. Like, no, you don't ask that. That's offensive. And I had no idea what that even meant.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And now being able to, I'd love for somebody to come ask me that. Sometimes in the church is the place where you least talk about faith, frankly.
Right, yeah. Right.
I would love, because we think we have it all figured out or we've chosen our sides and our camps and we're not going like, no, let's look at this again. Let's be challenged by it again and let's discover. Let's discover something together.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how your music comes to you, how you experience it, how it sort of changes, those moments that feel really right, or what do you do when it doesn't flow?
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's a variety of processes. People talk about their creative process, and I have processes. On a really good day, I sit down and it just, boop, comes out like a loaf of bread, just completely baked, done, ready to share. But those are very rare. Rare kind of gifts to me when that happens, because a lot of the time it's toil for me. Like, I'll have a seed of something, something that's been bugging me, or something somebody said, or something I picked up and made a little note on my phone. I have lots of notes on my phone, and I may have to write 10 songs about it before I get it out, and maybe I really like two of them.
Okay.
But it's just toiling. And I may write that song 5 times just trying to get it right. And I've done that over again, released it. Nope, that wasn't the right song. Red dress, revised. Write it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would call them little song seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I keep orbiting around some of them over and over again. One is death and how that's a catalyst for us to live well. You know, how death is such a potent, that expiration date is such a powerful thing. So I'm always orbiting around that. And another one is similarly painful relationships, relationships that are... like you don't want to give up on them because maybe it's a sibling, maybe it's a child, maybe it's a, you know, maybe it's a marriage. It's not disposable, so to speak, but dealing with that hurt and how to make it into something good, or just how to process it. That's where I go to process it. So a lot of the times I'm just orbiting around this idea, and it comes out in a variety of songs before I feel I'm done with it. If that answers your question. More recently, I've been, as I've been writing for film and TV, I get these pitches. And I love this. I just had a conversation with another artist here, a fantastic artist, and she was saying how that did not resonate with her to get a pitch, which is, can you write a song by Tuesday that is a sad song with some indie pop elements about home? To me, that's like, oh, parameters. I love this.
Freedom.
Yeah, and I can, and it has to be done by Wednesday, so I can't overthink it. I just have to get it done. And I still may have to write three songs to get there, but I love an assignment. It's just the first child type A of me. I don't know, but I really enjoy what comes out of that. So that's another process altogether. It's coming, starting with the end in mind, you know.
No.
It's so interesting because up until the past like four or five sentences you said, it could be, if nobody knew the context, that could have been a preacher talking about their process.
Right. Really?
You know, that trying to, I've heard a comparison of birthing a sermon and how it's like that labor, that emotional labor, that laboring through trying to birth it, which I don't have any children, so I'm not very good at it.
Yeah, my songs are my sermons, I think. I think they're very similar.
Yeah.
And they're usually sermons to me. Yeah, no, it's a lot of me preaching for me to get off my butt and just live well, love well. Yeah, no, that's interesting. It's probably a very similar process.
So what do you do when, one of the things that always kind of drives me a little bit bananas is like, I give a sermon and somebody walks up to me, shake hands at the door, hey, great sermon about whatever, and they heard something completely different.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that in your music?
I on my Instagram, I never know what to say. I'm not that clever on Instagram. So I use a lot of quotes, often from other musicians. And I just came across a really lovely one from Billie Eilish. If you're familiar with her, she's blowing up in the charts right now. And she said, when I write a song, I write it, it's yours, it's not mine. And whatever, you know. And that, again, is something I've just kind of wrestled with and thought about over the years. But I love when somebody else gets something out of a song. It doesn't have to be about what I wrote it about. In fact, I love hearing, a lot of times it comes with a story. If somebody's resonating with the song, they're coming up and they're telling me about usually a traumatic or painful experience in their life and how this song is ministered to it, which is like, I think of a, you know, backpacking through Europe and having packed way too much and you just get a really sore, your shoulder rubbed raw. And I just think of for me, how sometimes songs have just been like the salve on that. And the idea that my song could help them carry that weight for a little bit longer is really powerful. So take it. It's yours. It was mine to help me deal with what I was going through. And I think it's amazing. I love recycling. It's beautiful. You get to have a use out of it as well.
Well, you sort of answered my question because I was going to ask curiously about just the role of art. You know, is it public? Is it private? How is it shared? Who does it belong to? Who gets to interpret it? And it's tricky because for me, I guess there isn't a, just like with faith, it's more complicated. You know,
it's so complicated. That's the answer.
Yeah. It's
complicated.
Because frankly, there was this great song. I forget the band, but they wrote a song called Fly. Maybe you guys remember this. And it's like, it's seriously like, I believe I can.
Fly, like the
No. Just the word fly, and it was about, well, so it's describing like a fly, but I'm thinking it's talking about Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, you know, or it was talking about Hopefully you didn't pick up on that reference, because it's not a good reference at this time. But But yeah, no, so this song just really spoke to me at this time in college.
Sure, sure.
And I just thought, oh, is it about our masquerades and our how we're all fly? I mean, blah, blah, blah. And I remember reading an interview about the guy, and he just said, no, it's about a fly. I was in the studio, and I saw a fly, and I just sang about it.
Yeah,
and so in this weird way,
I've written with those. I think I've written with this guy.
But in this weird way, what it did for me, and maybe that's a personality fault, but what it did for me is I didn't listen to that song as much.
Yeah,
it didn't mean as much
after you knew.
Yeah, like or Dave Matthews Satellite. Oh. So Satellite, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, the mother station that we're communicating with the heavens. Da, da, da. He's like, no, I just wrote about satellites in the sky. And I was like, what? And so now I still enjoy that song. I've made peace with that song. But, you know, like, it's just interesting because to me it matters what somebody meant by it. And if I didn't really totally love what they meant by it, I'm happy adapting it. But if it's got to work a little bit. Like this guy singing about a fly, like I could be like, well, all right.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
But at the same time, I totally get you about. So this happens in the scriptures. You have people saying things that they clearly weren't convinced of. There's no way they would have known. So they're saying something almost prophetic that they could never have imagined. So when Isaiah is writing about the wonderful counselor, Prince of Peace, God with us, Emmanuel, there's no way he was imagining Jesus, right? He was thinking about a king. He was thinking about God's work, absolutely. But there's no way he would have thought in those terms. And... yet, Christians now interpret that passage in light of Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus is the wonderful counselor, the Prince of Peace, the Emmanuel, the Messiah promised to us, right? So, in a way, we still do that. And Paul's doing that. Mm. Jesus is the second Adam. He's the final Adam. He's been the perfecter of humanity. And, you know, so there are just many ways in which we recycle material. Mm-hmm. And maybe the thing that, it doesn't make the thing that was said less true.
Right.
But it gives it, there's an ultimate or a greater reality that it can inhabit, you know? So I could see that where that could be really meaningful, especially if you wrote it from a place of, I want this to be meaningful to people in whatever way it is.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is about a fly, just please tell me, just come out and say it. I spent a long time trying to figure it out, you know?
Yeah. I think, the best art, like you were saying, public or private, the best art is intensely private, you know? Mm. But maybe we get to share it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think of like a kaleidoscope or something where it's a tube, but it changes with what you're looking through. And I think of my songs that way. It's like, it's just a cardboard tube with some mirrors.
Yeah.
It's not really that fancy. Mm. But when you put light and colors of life through it, then it takes on a whole new thing that we can. But I think as humans, we just look for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
We're just meaning seekers.
Yeah.
I was
storytellers and meaning seekers. Yeah.
Is that American Life? There was this computer generating those cheesy sayings that we see with the sunset, you know. So they had a computer making those, and it made some profound, really profound statements. It's a computer. I don't know. I'm making horrible summation of this podcast, but it was really fascinating to me how we can read something like the blue sky drips cheese, you know, and we can
totally
at a deeper level it does drip cheese.
Totally, the moon is a giant made of cheese. Yeah.
We long for meaning. We look for it everywhere, under every rock.
Yeah,
and that says something to me about us, how we're built.
So we're wrapping up, so we've got a couple minutes. But of course, because we're wrapping up, I have two questions.
And
one of those questions is, are you surprised, being in the art and music industry that you're in LA, are you surprised by the number of people that have faith or don't, so whichever way?
Oh my.
And two, what would be your advice to someone seeking a career but is also, you know, their faith is really important to them? And how do they reconcile those, in a sense, if they can? Or how are they open to it?
First question, I found LA to be a surprisingly spiritual place.
Mm.
It's full of artists who are seeking guidance and synergy and direction in all kinds of mindfulness and openness. And I mean, there's just a lot of that there. I've also just been connected to a really beautiful church that is has a wonderful amount of diversity, and I think people just trying to figure it out at whatever level. I've been really surprised by that, really encouraged by it, and just part of the reason why I think this is where I'm supposed to be right now. And your second question was
somebody. It was so somebody looking to.
Advice. Boy. Well, I would say, you know, the biggest thing I would say is let people in on your dreams, hear advice. You don't have to take all of it, but be advised. And pray. That's been the biggest, the biggest thing for me, I think, is just the dialogue got clogged somewhere along the way. And as that has become unclogged, opportunity has just been raining on me like I can't even keep up with it. So, and it's not all about your dreams. You are about a larger thing. Allow your dreams to serve other people's, allow your talents to serve other people's dreams. And just see what happens with that. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing if we can all, if we can all help each other, you know, Philippians 2. Don't just be about your own interests, but also consider the interests of others. That has gone a long way for me. And it's a lesson I'm still learning. I'm kind of bad at it. Have to put the brake on, take a breath, and see what other people are about. But it's amazing how that feeds back to you.
That is a great place to end, because we certainly live in a culture that runs on individual dreams. So the idea of your dream serving others is just such a testament to God's love in Christ Jesus. So thank you so much for your time with us, Angela.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
And join us next time on our next podcast, the Riverfront 505 podcast. We hope this has been a blessing to you. If you want any more information about Angela Sheik and the work that she's doing, or Meredith Estevez and the work she's doing, the ways they're involved in their communities, please feel free to reach out to us on Facebook or at churchriverfront@gmail.com. And find us beginning June 2nd at 5:05 p.m. on the riverfront for our evening service. Take care. God bless.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Riverfront Church Broadcast. You can connect with us online at riverfrontwilmo.com or on Facebook. Just search for Riverfront Church in Wilmington, Delaware. May God meet you where you are and lead you where you are meant to go.